Okay, I think that's going. Okay. All right. Okay, see ya. Sorry, I just dropped my papers. So who am I talking to, actually?
Carrie.
Oh, right. Okay. And is it just you, or is...
And Corin.
And Corin as well?
Yeah, and actually, if you go, we'll give you Janet's number so that you could just maybe call her and just get a couple quotes or something.
Okay.
Because we... I mean, Corin and I usually do the interviews, or the bulk of the interviews, uh-huh. but we don't want it to totally be that way, so...
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
We just live in separate towns, so...
Oh, okay. Whereabouts do you live?
Well, Corin and I are in Olympia, and Janet's in Portland, so...
Oh, okay. Okay, hold on. I'm just trying to adjust the levels as we talk to kind of get them a little better. Okay. All right, so are there two of you on the phone right now, or just are you going to trade pass the phone?
I'm just going to have to pass the phone.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Okay.
Actually, there could be two. Do you still have your other phone?
Oh, yeah.
You can go plug it into the last room. Actually, if it's easier, we can both get on a different phone.
Yeah, okay, that might be better.
Okay.
Might save some time, I guess. Do you guys have time to talk and all that?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, you're not in a big rush?
No, this is planned.
Okay,
so.
All right. That's cool. So we're at, so you're both in this number's in Olympia then obviously. Is this is this your house or is this
it's a house that Corin is subletting right now. She moved up to Olympia.
Hello?
Hi.
That's Corin. Okay. She both Corin and Janet permanently reside in Olympia.
Uh-huh.
And Portland, sorry.
Okay.
And I live here, but Corin moved up here for a couple months so that we could concentrate more on writing. Because it's really hard to write songs all the time with us living in different places.
Right, split up and all that.
Yeah, and we're recording in December, so we really wanted to have more time.
Okay.
So.
Okay, so I guess we'll try and... I hope... the levels seem to be all right, so...
Okay.
I guess we'll officially start the interview right now.
All right.
Okay, so I guess if you could... let's see. Well, I'm talking to Carrie Brownstein and Corin Tucker. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And how old are you? Let's just get rid of the mundane stuff, I guess. What are your ages?
I'm 22. That's Carrie.
Uh-huh.
And I'm 23. I'm going to be 24, though.
Okay.
Like
someday?
Well, no, it's November 9th.
Right. Okay. So it's coming up.
Just to inform your readers.
Okay.
And I like chocolate.
All right. Fair enough. And are you, okay, so two of you live in Portland most of the time, even though Corin's in Olympia right now.
Right.
But where are you from originally?
I'm from Seattle, and...
Who is this?
Carrie, we'll just say her name before we talk.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Well, just through this mundane stuff, and then once after that, I don't think it really matters that much.
Okay, I'm from Seattle and surrounding suburbs.
Uh-huh. Such as?
Redmond.
Okay.
Not to be confused with Renton.
Okay.
And that's where I grew up.
Okay.
Until I moved here.
And when did you move to Olympia?
I moved in 1993 to go to Evergreen State College.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I still go there.
Okay. And what about yourself, Corin?
I grew up in Eugene,
uh-huh.
in Oregon.
Uh-huh.
So I went to high school there. After spending my family moved there when I was 11. So
uh-huh.
before that, I lived in North Dakota. Oh,
okay.
And then we lived in Eugene, and I went to high school there. And then I also moved to Olympia to go to Evergreen in 1990.
Okay. And how did you guys meet?
Well.
Was it through the university, or was it music-related?
Well, both. I actually, before, I lived in Bellingham
uh-huh.
for about a month and a half.
Okay.
And
were you going to the
school
there? I
went to Western, yeah.
Okay, right.
And Heavens to Betsy played a show up there, and I went to the show, and after they played, I introduced myself to Corin.
Uh-huh.
And just kind of wanted to know more information about stuff that they were doing and about Evergreen and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so we just briefly met, but we weren't friends or anything. But then when I moved to Olympia, at least we knew who the other person was.
Right.
And then we became friends and then started, you know, we didn't really play music, though, until later, for, you know, like 2 years into our friendship or something.
Right, okay.
Because Carrie joined XQ17.
Yeah.
But both of our bands played together.
Okay. So when, I guess, when did Heavens to Betsy get started, and when did Excuse 17 get started?
Well, Heavens to Betsy was kind of, got started around 1990.
Uh-huh.
I went to high school with Tracy Sawyer, so we always had wanted to be in a band together, but we didn't take it seriously. And then I moved to Olympia and started going to school and was really inspired by a lot of the bands in Olympia.
Uh-huh.
And so Tracy decided to move here as well.
Right.
And we really just taught ourselves everything then.
Right. Okay. And what about Excuse 17?
We started, I believe, in either the winter of, I guess probably the winter of 93.
Okay.
So really, really late 93. We started playing together.
Okay. And just, I guess, Excuse 17 was made up of yourself and then and two other women. Who
actually, one other woman and then a guy named CJ.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah, I'm spacing. Yeah, okay, that's right.
No, that's okay. Yeah. CJ Phillips and Becca Albee.
Right, and that was Kill Rock Stars as well, right?
Yeah.
And which was obviously the label for Heavens to Betsy, too.
Right.
Okay. Okay, I guess we're gonna move on to the more interesting
okay.
questions. I mean, you briefly mentioned the musical environment you came from, i.e., Olympia. Let's just call it the Olympia scene, for lack of a better term. I mean, what was it about the Olympia scene that turned you on to you know, to wanting to form a rock and roll band or you know, that kind of thing? Either one of you. What, I mean, which bands in particular, or, you know, I mean, what was it about you know, what you were seeing that was inspirational?
Well, for me, this is Carrie.
Uh-huh.
I think even before I moved to Olympia, it was the first time I saw Beat Happening. I was still in high school, and that was one of the first times that I saw a woman, you know, playing guitar, Heather,
uh-huh.
From Beat Happening.
Right.
And, you know, saw it up close, not at a big concert or
yeah.
anything.
Yeah.
And it suddenly seemed really accessible to me.
Yeah, exactly.
But more specifically, I think the music that I really caught on to and really identified with was when I saw, like, Bikini Kill,
mm-hmm.
Heavens to Betsy, and Brownmobile.
Uh-huh.
And that was a much, you know, a completely empowering experience and really affected just the way I thought about music
uh-huh.
and realized just the possibilities in terms of just kind of making do with what you have and having things be just really accessible and really, I don't know.
Yeah, just the immediate quality of the music, just how just how easy it is to get involved with rock and roll, I guess, or pick up the instruments and learn how to play the instruments. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, yeah. They had obviously just created a space for women to play music, and it was really inviting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of women were inspired by that to kind of take that idea and start bands in
start
you know wherever
thing, so.
They lived.
Yeah, right.
So.
Okay. And what about yourself, Corn?
That's also the same kind of thing that happened to me. I was always really interested in music and rock music and punk rock music.
Uh-huh.
Dating
back to when?
Birth, no. I grew up with a kind of a musical family, and my dad's a musician.
Uh-huh.
And
what kind of a musician?
He's like more of a folk performer.
Right, uh-huh.
And so I've always kind of grown up around music, but when I was in high school, I started getting more into like punk rock and
mm-hmm.
alternative rock and
yeah.
all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Do
you remember at any singular moment, i.e., you know, listening to a particular single or a an album or something, or having been to a concert that was the moment where it all made sense? Or
I have a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I've kind of described them in different interviews and stuff, but one of them was in high school on my like senior prom night or whatever they have in high school. I went and saw Mechanormal.
Uh-huh.
And they opened for Fugazi.
Uh-huh.
And so like Mechanormal just completely blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
I was 17 and
that's a nice Vancouver tie-in, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks.
Dean Smith has always been one of my heroes, you know. And
So
it's really exciting to have come from that kind of inspiration and
uh-huh.
be able to play with someone that's your hero,
uh-huh.
you know.
Yeah. And did, Carrie, you said that you'd seen Heavens to Betsy and Bikini Kill and Bratmobile. I mean, were those on separate occasions, or did Heavens to Betsy, Bikini Kill, and Bratmobile tour together? Or?
No, they definitely didn't.
We toured, yeah, Heavens to Betsy toured with Bratmobile.
Well, yeah, but I didn't see them together.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't just one big show or
yeah,
anything.
Right.
But I saw them on separate occasions. And I had gone to shows in Seattle, you know, for years in high school, but
mm-hmm.
it was just the first time that, you know, it was like, oh, I can do this too,
mm-hmm.
you know, because, and also, because, you know, just listening to, like, the Jam or the Buzzcocks or something, it never seemed like something I could be a part of, except for as a listener.
Right,
you know?
Right. But, so it was the live experience that that really made it clear?
Pardon?
Was it the live experience, you'd say made it really clear for you?
I think so.
Yeah.
Just in terms of, you know, realizing that it was something that I could do. I mean, I think, like, even just listening to the records, though, was, you know, inspiration enough to go out and, like, pick up a guitar. I mean, I actually already played music, and in high school had formed an all-girl band
mm-hmm.
that was pretty much a joke, even to the point where we had to consider it a joke, because otherwise, you know, that was...
Because it was safer
of, you know?
That way.
It was too scary to take it seriously.
Uh-huh, right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think that was, you know, the first time that
was it
I was
a covers
like,
band or something? Or?
No, I mean, we wrote our own songs.
Uh-huh.
But it was just, it was, we were just too, you know, there were the quote-unquote real bands, and those were the boy bands. And
yeah.
We were like a novelty band
right.
because we were women.
Right.
I mean, we totally wrote our own songs. So
and
I
this
think,
is when, like, late 80s or something? Or mid-80s?
Yeah, like,
or?
No, like 1990.
Oh, okay.
I'm younger than Korn, so I was still in high school.
Yeah, okay.
So, and this was, I mean, like the IPU and, you know, when I got a hold of like the Bikini Kill demo and that kind of stuff was 91.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't even realize, seeing that music and hearing that music was when I was like, it doesn't have to, it's not a novelty to be a woman in a band.
Yeah.
You know, it's legitimate, it's real, and you're writing your own songs. And they don't have to sound like, you know, these, like, boy bands that I'm listening to.
Right.
And you don't have to sit in your room and, you know, learn your guitar riffs and your solos before you play a show.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it's more about doing it than
yeah.
right, than having to prove yourself or get your badge or something like that. I mean,
right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, basically what we're talking about... you know, early 90s has to do with Riot Girl. I mean, I don't know how comfortable you guys are with being tied with that, if you find that too limiting or if you find that, you know, I don't know. I mean, that, you know, there was the Riot Girl scene or whatever going on. So how closely tied were you to that? I mean, I kind of know the answer to that, but but just for this interview, I guess.
Right.
Or is that too boring? Are you sick of hearing that kind of question? I mean, the thing is with Sleater-Kinney, actually, that's one question. How do you pronounce? Is it Sleater or Slater?
Slater.
Slater.
Slater? Okay, that's what I thought, but we were having an argument around the station about that. And does the, what's the story behind the name? Because I know driving down south a few weeks ago that there's a Sleater-Kinney Road in Olympia, but is there more to it than that?
They named the road after us, you know.
Wow. Quite the achievement.
No, Well, do you want us to answer the other question first, or do you want to go to this?
Yeah, actually, let's just take care of the Cinchy question first.
Okay.
Okay, well, yeah, this is Corinne, and I was really involved in Riot Girl, and Heavens to Betsy was involved in a lot of Riot Girl stuff, and it was a really important thing to me to be part of a group of young women who are activists and who wanted to speak out about a lot of different things, and I think it is really important. But I also think there was a lot of criticisms of Riot Girl that are, you know, definitely valid, and that I myself...
I mean, you participated in that yourself, I think.
Yeah, exactly. That I just, you know, after... It was just a really crazy time to be part of something that was important to me as a young person, you know, just sort of like figuring out things for myself, and also creating a space through like my own anger in music, and then to have it be this huge media blitz on MTV and Newsweek.
Yeah,
it was just totally insane. And
yeah, that's the thing that's interesting to me. I mean, I guess from my standpoint, I was abroad for a couple of years, 90 to 92, and I remember reading, you know, Maximum Rock and Roll articles on Bikini and Bikini Kill and that kind of thing, and kind of catching wind of something that was going on in the States that definitely hadn't been going on when I left, and just, you know, being so intrigued by what was going on, and then coming back. I'm from the Washington D.C. area, and coming back and, you know, seeing this pretty, you know, incredibly organized infrastructure of women's bands, women's zines, things like that going on, and it was, I mean, it was pretty mind blowing, you know, the kind of change that had occurred in a couple of years, you know, and obviously there's a pretty strong D.C. Olympia tie, but then, you know, I think the media, you know, the media influence or the media coverage really you know, had a huge influence in kind of breaking the whole thing up to a certain extent. I mean, not that, you know, it all disappeared, but I think that things have changed somewhat. Would you say that's pretty accurate? I mean, would you?
Yeah, I think one thing that happens with media is that they want to make some kind of star. You know what I mean? They always want to have this weird, like, Hollywood-type angle on the way that they sell their stories to the public. And I think it was really hard for people who felt, like, especially Bikini Kill, felt so targeted, like they were the stars of this. And their lives were suddenly public domain.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's why they've...
And they were being held accountable for...
Exactly.
You know,
for some stupid thing that some 14-year-old girl would say, they would be held accountable for.
Yeah.
And also the fact that, you know, feminism is not just one thing, you know what I mean? And that there was all these arguments in Riot Girl of, like, what things do we want to change? What, you know, what are our goals about? You know what I mean? And...
Yeah.
And so it's like there was a lot of things that people didn't agree on, and that especially if you're seen as, and this is something that's happened to me, is if you're seen as someone that people can look up to, you're also seen as someone that people can attack really easily.
Can be shot down. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like I want to encourage, you know, young women to keep, you know, struggling in different ways, and Riot Girl can be a way for some girls, you know, but I also think there's a lot of different ways that young women, you know, are activists within their own community, and I want to encourage that. But you know, I also, I guess I don't always see myself as like a leader.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of more of a person who's wanted to play music.
Yeah.
And that's...
Well, that's a lot of pressure too. I mean, to have to, you know, stand up and be, especially in a, you know, movement or a, you know, a, I guess a movement is a good term, but where, I mean, it was largely about discussion. It was largely about bringing issues, you know, to the front that hadn't been brought to the front. And it wasn't about, you know, issuing a Riot Girl manifesto that held for all women, you know?
Right.
But suddenly when you involve, when you start looking at personalities and, you know, attributing statements or whatever to certain personalities, then I think the whole thing gets tainted.
Plus, we're so young. I mean, I was like 18, you know, and it's like, I just think that it was just like, you know, she'd be taken for what it was, but it was just really kind of exploited by the media.
Yeah. Did you feel like you were in a whirlwind of sorts? I mean, were you being asked? I don't know. I mean, there was that Newsweek article that was quite famous and stuff. I mean, were you approached by the media?
Well, at the time I met Carrie, that we talked about that show that we played in Bellingham.
Yeah.
It was photographed by the New York Times.
Okay. Yeah.
So there's like a picture of the audience in this huge article in the New York Times.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
Yeah. So, like, we were just, you know, we were totally rambunctious, and we were just fighting with people left and right.
Yeah. I mean, the Newsweek article was particularly interesting because I think a lot of the people they interviewed, I mean, I don't know who they were. I mean, I don't know that they had anything really, I mean, they, in terms of being spokespeople for Riot Girl, I mean, you know, that claim was tenuous at best, you know?
It's like anybody can be a spokesperson for Riot Girl.
Yeah,
you know, my mom could be.
I know, but singling out three people, you know,
that
are the spokespeople for Riot Girl, I mean, it was pretty incredible.
Yeah,
But it was such a blitz. I mean, it happened so quickly, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how the media is.
Yeah, it sure is. So, I mean, has there been a similar kind of thing with Slater Kinney? I mean,
what's
it like being a post-Riot Girl band?
Right.
I mean, that's the
like
term that's
still
used.
Are carrying this thing around.
I mean, that's the term that's used over and over again in you know, regarding you guys.
Right. It's like, are we dead? You know what I mean? Like, what? You know what I mean? Like, it's just kind of like this strange thing. Whereas, like, if you're a woman band, you have to have, like, 10 million different labels.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I guess it's frustrating because we really just want to be seen as great writers and musicians.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, that's to us is our, I think, our common goal. And also, you know, like the things that we write about in our lives are totally important, and that they are things that we struggle with, and that's, you know, that is a part of being a writer. But that it is sometimes frustrating to feel like you have to always be tagged with all these different labels that makes it easier for like a reporter to write about you.
Yeah, for people to classify you and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, I wanted to bounce something off of you, which was, do you think Clinton's being elected to the presidency had anything to do with Riot Girl losing some of its focus? In the sense that it seemed like, you know, when you had the Bush administration, you had a very obvious patriarchal government in place. And do you think this move to the center, the quote-unquote center, had anything to do with Riot Girl maybe kind of becoming decentered?
That's a really interesting question. And, I mean, I definitely think that there was a radicalization of it as a women's group, and just women felt really, and the Bush administration felt really attacked because the abortion rights, you know, especially it's a really frightening thing, and that's actually one thing that I wrote a song about when I was like 18.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that, you know, I think that could be part of it, is that there was a real strong feeling of radicalization because of, like, you know,
because things
really
were so dismal for a while.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but on the, I think also that it really had more to do with the media than anything else, is feeling like we couldn't do anything without having it be watched, you know, and written about in ways that we weren't, you know, we weren't happy about.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole problem. I mean, it's all about control, really, you know, and, the, you know, I mean, the media or society or whatever finds it, that's one way of destroying something that that doesn't really fly with, you know, society at large is by, you know, by kind of claiming to cover it in the media and stuff, but at the same time, you know, it's a way of changing or steering, you know, Riot Girl in a different direction, you know, and taking control of it by, you know.
Like now there's Tank Girl and there's, yeah, you know, there's all these different things that are just like, God, you know, what a ripoff.
Yeah.
And the other thing though I think about in terms of Riot Girl itself is that, you know, the people who were involved in it were really a lot of times unsophisticated in terms of their activism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of the people who were involved with it, you know, really seriously, are trying to give themselves some time to grow up and to become maybe more sophisticated in their ideas about,
yeah,
you know, race, class, and gender, and,
yeah,
and to you know, that's, I think that's an important thing in it. So I think that there's a lot of different reasons, but I also think that the people who are involved with it are realized that they weren't perhaps the most prepared to organize some kind of, you know,
yeah,
social change movement.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, that was the I guess the catch 22 was that, I mean, a lot of the reason it was so exciting was because so many of the women who were involved were so young, but at the same time that ended up being part of the downfall because, you know, it took more than just enthusiasm to,
right,
to keep it going.
That's the sad thing is, like, you know, it was so easy to feel so alienated from older feminist groups.
Yeah.
You know, that were so caught up with assimilating and getting, you know, being like, and, you know, into all these, like, you know, women in corporations,
yeah,
you know, that's a great cause for women or whatever,
yeah, exactly,
you know, and that's what was so alienating. I think it is so alienating for young people is, like, to see these people who were totally radical in the 60s now have gotten older and have become way more into, you know, integration and assimilation. And,
yeah, and just becoming part of the system.
That's frustrating.
Yeah.
Because we could have, I mean, there are really radical feminist groups that we should have learned more from. There's,
yeah,
a lot of women of color radical groups that organize within their own communities, you know,
mm-hmm,
that Riot Girl was just too naive to hook up with.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so I think there's a lot of different things, but I'm going on and on, and
yeah,
Carrie's looking really bored, so we should
okay,
move on here.
Sure. So you guys are coming up here for this Rock for Choice benefit. Are you playing Rock for Choice dates in the States as well, or?
No, we're just playing the Canadian one.
Okay. And I guess one more political thing or something along that lines is, what's the state of pro-choice in the States right now for, you know, people up here in Canada who maybe don't know what's going on? I mean, why is Rock for Choice, I mean, still going strong, I guess? I mean, what's the fight? You know, briefly. I mean, under the, you know, is pro-choice still under attack?
Oh, yeah, it always is. I mean, there's people, you know, who get killed trying to have an abortion, or
yeah,
doctors who get killed trying to have to perform abortions.
Yeah,
it's.
I think it's interesting because it's. I think it's hard for a lot of Canadians to understand, you know, because things like that are somewhat secure up here, you know,
mm-hmm,
but just, yeah, I mean, it is a volatile situation in the States, you know,
mm-hmm,
even, you know, with Clinton's, you know, more or less, you know, or claiming to back pro-choice and all of that.
Yeah, I think that's a really big issue,
yeah,
part of his campaign.
Yeah.
I was reading an article today that said that there was like 60% of women voters are pro-Clinton,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to like the men are way more split, like Clinton and Dole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the abortion issue is a really big part of Clinton's like female support in America.
Yeah. Do you see the Clinton administration as having, you know, what have they done in terms of pro-choice? I mean, it's been on their platform both in 92 and in 96, but do you think that they've really, worked to protect pro-choice in America?
I don't think they've really worked to protect anything, but
yeah.
I mean, I think it's more of like just barely being able to hold on to the legalization of abortion
uh-huh.
in America. It's just such a backwards country in terms of like, you know, getting even, like I heard in England they have, what's that new contraception thing? It's like it's like a urine test for women
mm-hmm.
to see if they're fertile or not.
Right.
And it's like in England, you know, they totally have it, and it's, you can buy it like in a drugstore, but in America, like it won't be approved for like 10 more years probably.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an amazing thing because it's not like England is particularly progressive these days in a lot of other areas, you know. So why do they protect things like that? Whereas in the States, Roe v. Wade is constantly under attack.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, America is just like the whole issue of reproduction is always so volatile
mm-hmm.
and it's really violent. You know, it's supposed to, it's just such a farce that it's supposed to be, you know, saving, like, this fetus thing, you
yeah.
know, when it's just the whole, like, conservative movement is really, really violent.
Yeah.
And it's...
And fundamentally anti-woman.
Yeah, you know, and it's really targeted, you know, so that white women will have, you know, don't have abortions and stuff. But there's a lot of, like, women of color who are... you know, there are a lot of, like, doctors in this country have a history of having forced sterilization on, you know, and the whole
mm-hmm.
welfare system is,
yeah.
like, so down on black women
yeah.
who have families and raise families.
Yeah, and Hispanic women and the whole lot.
Exactly.
Yeah. yeah.
So
okay, along the same lines, I guess, you know, in terms of Sleater-Kinney's lyrics and, you know, the content of your songs and stuff, I mean, issues of the body and trauma and politics seem to be all over the place. You know, songs such as How to Play Dead, Call the Doctor, Heart Attack, even the Cindy Sherman-esque art on the cover of Call the Doctor, you know, lyrics such as Starve You Right Out of Me, donating my body to science from Heavens to Betsy, things like that. I mean, would you say that that's pretty accurate, that those kind of issues are a major concern with, or a major topic of, that Sleater-Kinney is dealing with?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely think, like, for us, for, you know, growing up at, and dealing with becoming women is a lot of battles that women fight are with their bodies or about their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in terms of writing about that and writing about your own lives, that those issues, for me at least, definitely come through
yeah.
again and again.
Yeah. The body becomes kind of a concrete battleground in a sense, you know. I guess it is for everybody in a sense, but I mean, in terms of women, it's things such as the attack on Roe v. Wade and all of that make it really crystal clear all the time. But, okay. I wanted to ask you about, your critical reception. What's your critical reception been like? I mean, is it something that you keep an eye on, or is it something that interests you in the least?
Well, I think that it's been...
Are you still there, Carrie?
I know. She's still, like, reading her book. So.
Hi. Sorry. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, Carrie, what do you think?
What?
We weren't even listening. He asked us, so what do we think about our critical reception? Is it something that even matters to us?
Well, like media?
Like rock criticism and things
right.
like that. I mean, do you...
Well, I think that... well, in my mind, I mean, the media is really fickle. And so it's like, even though it's, you know, it's helped... in terms of exposure of our band for people to be writing about it. And I'm glad that, you know, just the general, like, more people have heard about our music through writings. I don't
I don't ever want to, you know, count on the media in terms of, and, you know, critical reviews, because it really takes the focus away. It sort of brings on this whole, I guess it just takes the focus away from the music, and the music to us is what is important, and, you know, as long as we were really proud of Call the Doctor, and even if, you know, no one had written about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, we would have liked it anyway.
Yeah, so you're not doing it for the rock critics.
Pardon?
You're not doing it for the rock critics.
Exactly, and right. and so, I kind of just have to, you know, take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, yeah. I've got it. I've got that interview article on you by Greil Marcus in front of me, which I assume you've seen.
Yeah.
It's a pretty glowing article.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel about articles like that being written about you? I mean, he makes a lot of cultural references in his, you know, article on you as well. Do those make any sense to you? Or, I mean, is it all crap, or did you read the article and think, what is he talking about? Or
no, I mean, for me, this is Corin. He's written about Heavens to Betsy and Slater Kinney
uh-huh.
for a long time,
as well as Bikini Kill and
right, him. Exactly.
Yeah,
he's been really supportive of, you know, a lot of different things within like the, you know, music scene that's been, you know, girls and women kind of doing feminist music and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he's coming from a good place, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that he has a way of writing that's really his own style, but that I think that he's...
You don't have to mince your words.
No. I mean, I like his writing.
Yeah.
I
do too.
So I think that it's been really nice for us to have someone. Sometimes it's easier for people like that to have different perspectives on things. So
mm-hmm.
it's always interesting to me to read what people have to say.
Yeah.
And his work I do respect, whereas other writers who've written about us, I don't at all.
Yeah.
You know, but I guess I just want to...
What about that Option article that's out in the most recent Option?
Oh, yeah. I really like that article.
Yeah.
I think she's great.
Yeah.
And I was really very happy to finally be interviewed by a woman, you know. And
sorry.
To have a woman, not to diss you or anything, but, you know...
Does it not happen that often?
It doesn't. That was
That's remarkable.
I mean... We've been interviewed by so many men, and it's just, it's fine. There's been a lot of men who are really supportive,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it was just a really good thing, and so I was happy about that.
I came into this thinking that this would be a fluke, kind of. I don't know why I thought that, but, you know.
No.
Yeah.
It's just sad that, again, like the people who are doing things in the music and in any part of the industry or any part of the underground scene is...
Yeah.
It's just women are kind of few and hard to find.
Yeah. Well, just so you know, there were two other women who wanted to do this interview, but I kind of signed up for it first. So,
uh-huh.
So it's not like the women here don't know about you.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe they can write something.
Yeah, exactly. When you come up and play or something.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, back to the Marcus article. We talked a bit about media and all of that, and it is, it's a really interesting article, and I think it's it brings up some really good points, especially about the energy, surrounding your music. I think that's one of the best things about Greil Marcus is that he has an ability to get inside of the music and make you excited about the music, even if you haven't heard it before. But in any case, it is an interview magazine, and how do you feel about an article like that about yourselves being in a magazine such as Interview, sandwiched between articles on, Demi Moore and, you know, perfume advertisements and, you know, stuff like that?
Well, I mean,
do you see it as being interventionist, or do you, anyways, go ahead, answer the question. I don't want to cut you off.
Oh, this is Carrie. great. I mean, I think that any time you allow yourself to, or you place yourself within the context of mainstream media, I mean, granted, that wasn't an interview. You know, we didn't answer questions. But I think we've definitely allowed ourselves to be more open to doing interviews and being written about in mainstream magazines. Mm-hmm. And whether it's interview, which is more of like, you know, like pop culture, fashion, you know, Demi Moore type things, or if it's Rolling Stone. I mean, even in Rolling Stone or Spin, you have the chance of being next to, you know, some sexist ad or something.
Yeah.
Anytime you're dealing with, you know, a music magazine or a fashion magazine, you practically have an equal chance of, like, having the next page be by, you know, someone that you would never want to talk to or would never want to be next to.
Yeah.
It's just sort of a risk you take, and it is, I mean...
I guess it's a risk you take by making music, period, because you never know whose record collection you're going to end up in and, you know, whose records you'll be next to.
Exactly, and that's why you just have to hope that, you know, that you're... that the way you're represented is true to, you know, what you actually said in the interview,
mm-hmm.
or is, you know, true to your own art. I mean, you know, in interviews, there's that huge gap between what you're saying and how the interviewer interprets that information,
yeah.
and you just have to hope that it's transmitted in a way that, or received in a way that, you know, you intended. But I just think that, you know, yeah, everything about playing music is a risk, so
yeah.
you might as well just go for it.
Yeah. So you're not about to tuck yourself in a corner?
No, I mean, we're already out there. We're
yeah.
already...
It's a public realm.
Exactly. I mean, we're not going to... I don't know. You
yeah.
know, we don't do every interview, but I'm not... You know, I'm open. I'm also, you know, there's... It's also something where, I mean, you can limit yourselves to, you know, fanzines and, you know, local papers and that sort of thing, but... You know, only certain people have, like, the privilege of existing in, like, a thriving music scene where there's a lot of women and a lot of different kinds of artists. And but when you travel around the U.S., you realize that, you know, sometimes the only access people have to music is in Spin or is in Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
So I think it is also sort of limiting.
Yeah.
And we don't really want to limit ourselves to... a punk rock community, because the punk rock community itself is pretty homogenous.
Yeah.
And if we're going to reach out to a bigger audience, you know, we have to, you know, put ourselves in bigger mediums.
Yeah. What about going major label? I mean, what's your feeling about that kind of a move? I mean, could you ever see yourself going major label?
Well, I think that, you know, for now, oh, this is Carrie, by the way, that's
mm-hmm.
talking.
Yeah.
we
I recognize your voices.
Oh,
now,
okay,
so
good. So you don't have to, like, identify.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, with Call the Doctor, and we've gotten a lot of attention from major labels, and I think that one of the reasons, or one of the things that major labels tend to do is to really make you feel like, you know, this is it, this is your one chance. If you don't take it now, you know, you're never going to do anything good again. And it's just really focused on, you know, the right now and not anything like long-term or
yeah.
paced. And that's one of the reasons, you know, we're doing our next record with an independent label.
Yeah, which is?
Kill Rock Stars.
Okay. What? Okay. Why not Chainsaw?
We're just looking for a bigger distribution.
Okay.
They just have a different distribution company.
Okay. Oh, I'm losing you.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
No, you just trailed off there for a second.
Okay. So, I mean, I just think that, you know, we've kind of grown up in an independent community in terms of music.
Yeah.
And the focus, you know, has always been on the music and not on the money and not on putting out a hit record.
Yeah.
And I just think we have more room to grow with an independent.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's totally... you know, out of the question to be on a major label, but I don't think it's something we're going to do in the...
Yeah, you don't see it happening anytime soon.
Yeah. Hey, hold on. Come on.
Hello? Hello?
I'm just asking, maybe you should just put that our next record is coming out independent.
Okay.
Not silly Kill Rock Stars.
Okay.
You don't want to...
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fine. I can do that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about your music. I mean, how do you compose your songs? You know, do lyrics precede music? Does music precede lyrics? I mean, you know, what's the nitty-gritty?
Well, when we write songs, we usually, Carrie and I, play guitar together.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we've been doing it for this album, next album especially, and
uh-huh.
I really am happy with how a lot of the songs are coming together. Cause
how many songs do you have so far?
About 10.
Uh-huh.
I think that we sort of took the cue from the last record, or Call the Doctor. I mean, the songs that we really love from the last record are the ones that we co-wrote. I mean, we always write our own guitar parts and sing our own lyrics, but a lot of the songs that I think turn out the best are the ones with the most energy and dynamics are the ones where, you know, Korn will write the verse in terms of music and I'll come up with the next part, or I'll write music and Korn will sing over it.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
and which songs were those?
Songs like Little Mouth,
uh-huh.
Call the Doctor,
mm-hmm.
Call the Doctor,
I'm Not Waiting.
Uh-huh.
That one was hardly even a song. Okay.
Meaning what?
What?
Meaning what? What is it?
What?
What does it mean that it was hardly even a song?
Yeah,
well, Carrie started doing something. I was like, keep doing that. Keep doing that. And so I wrote a part to it. She was like, I hate this. Like, what are you doing?
Uh-huh.
But sometimes those make the best songs. It's kind of the same thing with Little Mouth, whereas, like, my guitar part, the
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was really slow. So, but then
originally,
yeah. So it's I think it's like this kind of the tension of working with another person sometimes creates better songs.
Uh-huh.
You know, because you have more spontaneity sometimes.
Uh-huh.
But I also think that because I mean still much of our, or at least on Call the Doctor, a lot of our songwriting was a guitar part that we brought in for the complete song, but we both, you know, the songs definitely don't sound complete until the other person adds something.
Yeah.
Like if Korn brings in a song, like Good Things, you know, I add a guitar part, which I think makes the song more complete, or Joy Ramone, which I brought in, and with, you know, the chorus, which Korn sings, you know, is, you know, you can't, that's one of the best parts of the song, you know, in terms of, like, energy and dynamics. So
uh-huh.
I think that everything we do is just really collaborative, and it's really, you know, it's sort of gotten to the point where we're co-authors in the sense where our songs are almost, they're not really complete until both of us have written something,
mm-hmm.
and the drums. I mean, we don't just have, like, one songwriter that has a song beginning to end with lyrics and an idea for the other person and this. It's, our songs take shape as the other person writes their part.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And how is that different from your previous bands? I mean, do you find that the dynamics in Sleater-Kinney are just entirely different from Heavens to Betsy and Excuse 17?
Yeah. I think that in terms of with me and Korn, I think we're constantly being inspired by one another, and also, and even with Janet too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that constant, like, just inspiration, it really just fuels an energy that I don't think was matched by either of our other bands.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's a new energy, and it's also has sort of an excitement that I think is constantly, like, regenerated and sort of, I don't know, and I think just our ability to songwrite together is unique from our other bands.
I mean,
Korn can talk about it. I mean, she didn't have... Go ahead, Korn. It's different. I mean, obviously, this is the first time, like, Korn's writing with another guitar player,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's going to change things, and I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I think, like, it is, I think if there is the excitement that people get from Sleater-Kinney is the excitement of Carrie and I writing together and playing together, and that's the core of why Sleater-Kinney just took off like it did,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
Well, how did it take off? I mean, you know, was you said that it took off like it did. I mean, basically that implies that. I mean, what's the reaction been like to Sleater-Kinney? I mean, are you selling tons of records? Are you?
We're not selling tons of records.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, I think that. I mean, that is sort of false as well. I mean, in terms of like independent music, we're selling a good amount of records. Unfortunately, the distribution isn't there.
Uh-huh.
Our records are constantly, you know, I'll go into a record store and they won't have it.
Yeah.
That's sort of frustrating. In terms of audience reaction, I think, I think people were just, I mean, completely just like, I don't know, just like rejuvenated or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people have talked about, oh, you guys remind me of, you know, when I, way back in the 70s or something, when I used to, I mean, people just have, but yet again, the music is completely original.
Yeah.
But it kind of, I think people were just, you know, excited by like something that, of an interaction. And also, we're not a band that you can just sit back and watch. We're not
a
bar band, and we're not, it's very active.
Yeah.
And it's very, in your face, but not in terms of, you know, like, we're not cramming anything down anyone's throat, but it's just, it's like, you have to stand up and pay attention. I mean, it's three women, you know, one of them has, you know, a voice that could, like, reach every corner of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and it's, I can, you know, I'm jumping around stage playing guitar, and it's just very, I think people are often just surprised.
Yeah.
You know, just, wow, like, you guys are, this is a rock band, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that Janet was talking about. She said that some people...
How long has Janet been with the band? Just
like, about 2 months, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Oops,
hold on. I've got to flip this tape, actually.
Okay.
So just hold on a second. Okay. Just wait a second or two.
Well, I was just going to say that Janet's just a really super dynamic drummer, and she's also just a real, really amazing performer. And she's just really performance-oriented, which I think is really great for me and Carrie because we love performing.
Yeah.
One thing she said is that recently we played a show at La Luna and some people from her work came and...
What's La Luna?
Oh, Portland.
Okay.
Yeah. And that it was just... They were just kind of like... They're like overwhelmed in a way that they were like, that was really great, but it was kind of... I mean, it's uncomfortable. It's not like you're going to go see, you know... a performer like a bar band where you can just kind of watch and have a conversation.
Right.
And then that's to me why I love performing is because, you know, I love pop music and I love writing pop songs, but I'm not really satisfied unless I kind of make people uncomfortable as well.
Yeah.
Or just challenge them in some way.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that kills me about most indie pop is that, you know, I think the voice, in particular is so underused in a lot of in music in general, but even in, so-called independent pop, because most bands just sit back and kind of play it safe in terms of, how they do vocals and stuff. And I think the bands that I gravitate towards are pushing the vocals to into areas that people don't typically go. And I think that's obviously the music is incredibly important as well. A lot of times it's the voice that separates, you know, a good band from a band that's, you know, like you say, a bar band or what have you. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the chemistry in Sleater-Kinney just makes that approach to performance possible, or is do you think that you learn things from your earlier bands that you've now applied to Sleater-Kinney?
I think that for me,
I mean, Sleater-Kinney is a completely new experience. I mean, I think someone noted the other day, it was actually in another interview, that it was such an amazing contrast from how I played in Excuse 17 to Sleater-Kinney. And I think that, I mean, it's not only the chemistry, but just, I think, the confidence that mm-hmm. we have in each other and in our music and in ourselves, that I think has probably increased since, or at least for me,
mm-hmm.
since my previous bands. I mean, definitely I learned a lot of things in Excuse 17, but I think that I'm able to really let myself go a little bit mm-hmm. as a performer, and I'm also a lot more comfortable with the idea of performance now than I was before. And
I'm glad to hear that you guys use that term even, you know, because I think there's a lot of the time there's the, you know, so little attention drawn to performance, you know, or the power of being on stage and having the ability to perform, you know.
Right. And I also think that for me, the best part of being in Sleater-Kinney is playing live and playing in front of people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can sit at home and listen to a record and it's going to sound the same every time. And, you know, playing live, there's the element of spontaneity.
Yeah.
And it's also in the interaction, you know, it's like the communication between the audience and the band.
Yeah.
That can only be achieved by, like, it's not just, you know, a one-way transmission. I love it when, you know, the audience's energy matches ours.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most important thing, is a connection. So I think that since we like playing live so much, that it's, I think that's probably a big difference for me also in Sleater-Kinney, is that that's the main thing.
Yeah. What about yourself, Corin?
I completely agree with Carrie in terms of Sleater-Kinney and our love for performing, and our, the fact that we are, both of us are more able now to connect with an audience and to let ourselves go with the music
mm-hmm.
and really just rock,
yeah.
I guess.
And what's the audience response been like as you tour around?
It's been different in different places.
Yeah.
Do
you feel like you're reaching audiences a lot? I mean, do you, you know, I mean, do you feel like the response has been, you know, what you expect most of the time or all of the time? Or
I think that, I mean, I really don't have any expectations in terms of how the audience is going to receive our music. But one thing I've noticed with Sleater-Kinney compared to probably our other bands,